Warning, this is an episode of Seriously Wrong.
You know my mama was a librarian.
Seriously, seriously.
She set me straight if I was too headstrong.
Seriously, seriously.
She'd sit me down and say, listen, son, when you're sure you're right, you're probably wrong.
Seriously, seriously wrong.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Seriously Wrong audio luxury experience.
Audio luxury experience. I think that's where we've landed. Because the term podcast, bless it.
It's clear that we've sort of ascended from...
It doesn't evoke the same feeling of being pampered at a spa that we like to bring to every episode. So
yeah, we strive to achieve that. We don't always hit the mark, but I think, you know, fundamentally we are doing an ALE here, and it's an audio luxury experience.
Yeah,
last week the conversation with Eleanor, recorded it some time ago before we released it, and we put it in, we're going to do this after Papa and Boy, and then when we listened to it, we're like, that's actually crazy how much is threaded together here in one conversation.
Yeah, it's weird to say about your own show, but I guess we've been talking up our own show since we started this episode already. But we were just listening back to parts of it being like, damn, this is so great.
And yeah, like really important and sort of like underdeveloped stuff in a way. One thing you highlighted, but I felt it too when we were listening back, was the hope is a commitment piece at the end.
Yeah, she's talking about doom scrolling and this experience of feeling like everything is hopeless and it's all going wrong and there's no way we can get out of this. And the counter to that being that, like, hope is a commitment just hits. It's also just feels really true, like that you can't do anything unless you hope for a particular outcome, unless you like have at least some level of hope that it could turn out to actually happen. Because just the way like your brain works when you're categorizing between all the things you can do, if you are constantly putting something in the category of impossible, then like it's completely like you just would never think to put time or effort into that. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. And then, yeah, I don't know. There is a lot of bad shit happening in the world, but when you look at any of the good things that do happen, think about Zoran being elected mayor in New York. The energy behind that campaign and his commitment to hope was really like obvious right from the start. And as soon as I saw his things, I was like, oh, that's awesome. Even I think one of the first things I thought about him was probably, what a great campaign. It's too bad he'd never actually win and be mayor. This is like in the primary when he's doing early, early stuff. And I was wrong. My skepticism was proven incorrect from the power of their commitment to the idea that things are possible.
One of the things I thought on when I was thinking about like the type of hope I feel when I'm engaging in political action is it's almost like there's like a continuum between hope and a type of knowledge, a knowledge that comes from experience. Like, is it the word phronesis?
Yeah, like applied knowledge or like the type of knowledge of actually having done something.
Yeah, it's like a Greek word for a type of knowledge that's like the shoemaker's knowledge of the shoe. It has a detailed, multifaceted and like sensorial quality that embeds them with this deeper capacity to give advice and experience, like from their experience.
Yeah.
And I feel like in terms of political hope and like the understanding that a better world is possible, to me, that feels like a fact. And like, we've talked about this around the show a little bit, had arguments with friends about this, about whether or not possibility is real, like, or if it is real, like what, how does that, what shape is the realness of possibility? But I do like in my political action, I feel like I know that a better thing is possible, a bigger thing is possible because I mean, like, does the shoemaker hope that he'll have a shoe at the end of the process? Does the chair maker hope that he's going to have a wonderful chair? Like in some types, there's spectrums within that, that you hope that the wood grain is going to work out or whatever. I don't know. Like maybe some chairs turn out better or worse when you're making chairs by hand.
Yeah.
But there's a certain like type of applied knowledge and confidence about the shape of reality that gives you like a deeper grounding than even hope on these things that I feel like I get a sense of that, not a complete sense of that, not like a master craftsperson, but I get a sense of that through participation in political action and seeing the movement and touching the external world and having it work.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's like a practical knowledge that things are possible because you've experienced the process of participating in things happening. I think, yeah, too, even from that perspective, though, it's like hope is a crucial part of it, because when you don't have that experiential aspect of it, one way that you're going to get people excited is to inspire hope in them for something, even if it's something like, oh, we can get rid of Donald Trump or get rid of some bad politician. Even that's a type of hope in a way. But yeah, obviously, like, hope without any knowledge of how to actually organize towards whatever political end you're organizing towards isn't useful. And even knowledge of how to organize is like going to be nowhere near as useful theoretically as that phronesis type knowledge of having participated in things like this before.
I think that there's other types of participation too that also give me a sense of confidence about the world of possibility, and reading research on like the climate change situation that we're in, reading papers and discussions on what different pathways out of this look like, done by groups of engineers, scientists, et cetera, who are trying to study this stuff. Like, familiarity with that kind of canon, which for me is probably significantly above the average person, but significantly below a moderate expert in any of the individual fields connected to this. I feel like I have it on good authority that you can turn this bad boy around. That's also kind of like a relief compared to the possibility of thinking, oh, we're going to start doing all this work and then we're going to look at the papers and it's actually impossible. And it was just like doomed from the whole time. And we spent all this time stretching ourselves out and fucking putting pressure on our personal lives to be part of political movements that don't result in any sort of, if you believe that even if we had total control of the world's institutions and we had a transitionary plan around democracy and climate inequality and so on, that material reality itself would block such a transition. Yeah, that would be
an ultimate block on any kind of hope. It's like closing off. It's like the complete opposite of what I was talking about at the start. It's like you can't do anything. Like you very literally can't do anything if there's nothing that you can see that is possible to do.
But actually, this highlights to me my commitment to hope, which was unconscious to me outside of this, and that I'm like, even then, you could do a lot. It could be different. It could be like you could go through that time thrashing for virtue.
There's levels, you know, of like, bad. Yeah, in any situation, there's still an array of outcomes. Even if it's from bad to worse, it might be better to shoot for bad in that situation.
Maybe we should strive for something. Like, maybe we should act, even if we found it that was true, we should act as if it's not true so we can get into something that is deeper and more important than heaven. Like,
or not act as if it's just to blow past that.
it's like insane meta, like fucking, yeah. I'm talking about something like heaven, except more. I'm not saying heaven's not real, but I'm saying this definitely is real and it's more important and deeper and more like transcendent and like the highest register, the register, heaven's heaven. That's of all possible heavens. One heaven deeper.
There's a sense which I think acting as if it's not real, it's just like the way you phrased it. Obviously, you don't want to pretend something's not true that is true. But also, like, the statement of there is nothing we can do is making a knowledge claim about all things that are possible to do. And that's never really the situation that human beings are in. New possibilities can pop up all the time in terms of even just like understanding different things that exist in different ways they can be organized in order to create certain outcomes. That's like very removed from anything concrete, but reading about different academics and like people who have really thought about scale of the problems that we're facing and like who have solid groundings in fact, who are making these evidence-based cases for different ways to go about pathways out of the crises that we're facing. Seeing competent people tackling that problem and coming up with plausible solutions to part of it or things that could be part of a package of solutions to all of it, that both inspires hope and grounds it in a real knowledge of facts, which is, yeah, the strongest basis you're going to have for that type of hope. And there's an interesting connection there between information and hope, because the more information you have about different possibilities, especially positive possibilities, the more basis you can have to have that actual hope for things. Because without the information, you wouldn't have anything to hope for. If all you've ever seen is reasons that we're dying and not ways out of it, then there's nothing to ground your hope in.
Yeah. Politics is about arranging and rearranging information in collective ways and a lot of levels, but it's also about relationships. And I think it's interesting, yeah, highlighting that interaction between information and hope, which is, I didn't look up the definition of hope before we started talking. And now I feel like it's like when you keep on repeating a word and you have the semantic saturation of it. I'm like, what is this hope? What is hope? Is it like, is hope a theory? Is hope a feeling? Is hope, like, I think of hope as like a, I guess it's a, sort of a disposition. It's a feeling and it's a strategy. It's like a coping strategy in adversity.
Yeah. Yeah. I think of it as the idea that the feeling that is a, I don't know what, yeah, I guess it's called
confidence,
hope, but like,
it's like confidence. It's a type of confidence about.
I see one definition from the Google search AI overview that says it's an optimistic state of mind defined as the desire for positive outcomes combined with the expectation that it is attainable. So yeah, that like, oh, I have no hope that this could happen. Or yeah, I'm hopeful, or I'm really hopeful. Like that kind of is, yeah, gauging your confidence in a way. Or in some case, I guess, yeah, it does get a bit wobbly, because in some ways, the more confident you are, the less you feel like you maybe need hope. But that's depending on how you define it. But
yeah, I feel like strong hope is a level of confidence that's built on phronesis. And like weak hope is a, with varying degrees of confidence, a happy guess that makes you feel good. And the spectrum of, say, I want to say full political hope, if I could be so bold,
right,
at the top, confidence based on experience. And then at the bottom, happy little guesses that make you smile in hard times. Both are good, and it's a big spectrum. But the happiest guess that makes you smile the biggest is the one that's built on deep phronesis.
Yeah.
Also, I think phronesis, like the secondhand phronesis thing, is interesting. If someone has this familiarity with the things and you're judging their judgments as a proxy for that knowledge, that also connects to like the glorious convivial glue of neighborly love, which was talked about last episode, in contexts where there is more mutually familiar neighborly love connections with people with a variety of different experiences and knowledge bases and stuff. Having a connected community of people who understand and know each other and also understand what each other know themselves and have, where you have trust with them. Like, trust is such an important part of even the believing in someone's phronesis. Are they misleading me or not? Are they on my side or not? You notice in politics, sometimes you can have two people say the exact same thing, but one of them is your friend and one of them's not. And the register feels totally different and people act totally different. Mm-hmm. In politics, people get like scattered and confused about who is their friend sometimes, which I think, yeah, takes the form of sometimes like criticizing leftists more than centrists or right wingers as narcissism of small differences or whatever, or just like an interesting thing there around organizational failures on the left that are often criticized is, I do think that convivial glue of neighborly love is one of the things that's missing. You think of there's both good and bad critiques of like call out culture and things like that. But the basis of the good critiques, the ones that everyone quietly agreed with and then later more openly agreed with as we went through the process of social transformation around awareness of these things, like, part of what's missing there in the toxic form of this kind of stuff is like not having that neighborly love of having a, you know, an escalation of relationship building that comes out of conflict, and instead turning to an audience and being like, fuck that person. People getting caught in like this kind of like ego, individual, good pile, bad pile kind of framework and all that stuff. I feel like there's this sort of interrelatedness to these ideas.
Yeah, I was thinking about the phronesis piece and the neighborly love sometimes even in our current system where there's social services available or programs that people could get help with, they don't know anybody who knows how to navigate those systems to like get them into it. There's not that secondhand phronesis they can rely on to figure out how to access those kinds of things. And like, I was thinking about like how even just like having a friend who knows a bit more technical stuff, you could ask like a question about your computer too. That phronesis is always really valuable. Like, oh, what does it mean if my CPU is at 100% all the time? Or what, like some random fuck ass question. Or asking your mom, like, every time I make cookies, they're bad. They look like this. They're not good. Can you help? Because she's got the phronesis on that. That having those social connections with people who have the embodied knowledge on how to do things and like that chain of connections can enable people to have so much more. It can connect them to the things that they need to do or they want to do. And yeah, a big part of a missing community is not having a place where you can connect to, because you can't have like phronesis in every sphere of the world. Every amount of time you spend doing any particular thing and gaining that applied knowledge in it is time that you're not spending doing something else. So we have to rely on each other to help us out with things that we don't know about as much. And the more that you can have those relevant connections, the more that you'll be supported in those things that you don't know how to do as well.
Yeah, no, like having a bigger community and more people that you have, say, good relationships with, if not close relationships, with that comes the good Lord's original ChatGPT. People can answer your questions on topics that are relevant to your queries.
And not even just answer questions, because yeah, ChatGPT can give you information and Google can give you information. And someone who is looking for social programs can use those as resources to figure out how to get access to them. But they like it's a weird thing with AI that it has a lot of the information and none of the phronesis. I don't know.
Yeah, actually, no, that's why you should not let it make decisions, basically. It's like
right,
part
right.
God and part toddler. And yeah, up until you said that, I regretted bringing up ChatGPT. And I was like, I don't, but no, that's such an important point, actually. The lack of phronesis is spot on. And that's also what that is maybe the human advantage in the war against the machines, is that we have intergenerational inferences beyond context that are passed down through various rituals. Like this is weird too. I'm just thinking out loud here, but like if you think about like the ancestral knowledge that is passed on through generations, like when you mentioned mom making cookies, I was like, that's grandma's recipe. And maybe she got it in a catalog in 1958 or whatever. And now it's become the family recipe or something.
Yeah. That's, even then, usually like you got it from a catalog and then you started being like, oh, maybe I'll throw some of this in there. Or I always make it with a bit of extra this, or things become your own through those little changes.
Yeah, but then there's also continuity between the values, virtues, and life ways of a family, of parents to children at the very least, or other social units that is, yeah, the...
Yeah, or even like car mechanic knowledge is passed down through apprentice...
Yeah, dead workers. Whatever, like... It's embedded with the fucking dead workers of history, the knowledge right. base of the dead workers. They've been boiled down like a sticky tar and
every time you
intergenerationally.
Like, spend some time with car mechanics, you're like getting some of that intergenerational knowledge phronesis. Yeah.
Yeah. None of the mechanics just got there, started figuring out how it all works and naming things themselves. They all
right.
got taught by someone over a period of time. And that, yeah, like the ability of these LLMs and so on to the lack of ability that these AI systems have to differentiate between sense and nonsense is directly related to their lack of phronesis, which is maybe part of consciousness in what we're talking about, why AI is not alive, a lack of experience. Yeah, does it have experience in some weird sense?
I think if I think it has experience, then I have to think that everything computers do has some type of experience, and maybe it's a bit more human because it's calculating all this language, and language is a very human thing. But I don't know if that's where experience comes from. Yeah, I don't know. So yeah, it seems like building up this kind of knowledge of better possibilities and phronesis of organizing are like two really strong foundations for hope.
And I think this is a distinction that probably doesn't matter that much, but I feel like knowledge is a type of phronesis. Like familiarity with material is also, even if it's just abstract book learning, there's a type of phronesis there, but it's like the full spectrum phronesis that would involve hands-on stuff as well.
Yeah, there's, I think about that too a lot when I hear people debating people who, especially like TikTok debaters who are like, they do this all day and the people who call in are just like, I don't know, I think this. There's one person who has all this like depth experience with all the branching versions of this idea that we're talking about here, or this policy or whatever this like thing is, this debate. And then there's another person who has very limited phronesis with that thought space. There's, yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, having the experience of thinking down multiple pathways of a philosophical concept, which can feel like, oh, you have a really great understanding of this abstract idea space or whatever. What does that have to do with anything? But in the real world, when you're dealing with these political situations, questions come up all the time of, what about this? And they're like, the public or whoever you're trying to make a political appeal to is, oh, they made a really good point on that other side. Like, do you have a response to that? And if you don't have a good understanding of the political idea space, people with less phronesis in like thinking through all these ideas are going to be like, oh, I know that's wrong, but I don't know how to articulate it. I don't know I can feel the shape of it, but I don't know the words or what. Yeah. Informational phronesis is useful in the realm of political debate, which is going to be central to a democracy where people are putting ideas up against each other.
Yeah, it's interesting. Is that, I guess, like, it's inevitable. I just stumbled on the democratic idea because I think I was just vibing on the convivial glue of neighborly love, which I feel like is...
Yeah, like the convivial glue of neighborly love is like the howling void at the center of debate culture.
Yeah, that's what I was like being... It feels like in some way debate, the wrong type of debate is the opposite.
Yeah, I guess like people use the term debate just to mean being mean to each other while debate, but I just mean debate in terms of should we pass this or should we not. People are going to express their ideas. There's going to be disagreements about that. That's, unless you're imagining a democratic society where everybody agrees all the time, or you define debate as only when it's mean and bad. There's going to be some debate. But I think, yeah, the convivial glue of neighborly love is like what allows you to have debates with people in a framework that we all know that we all want what's best for us, and we're, yeah, like a good, fruitful discussion, debate, whatever, becomes pretty much impossible in situations where people feel like the other side's trying to harm them.
Yeah, secret foreign agent, Antifa, whatever, people who are like, yeah,
rooting for the quality. Destruction of society, or...
Like, I'm not criticizing debate through the lens of everyone must listen to Glorious Leader and that's how you have a utopian, beautiful utopian future. But it is interesting, like the political, yeah, debate being treated as like fundamental to democracy because of that outside force of stifling or preventing debate is in the comparison of ideas. But then debate is also strongly associated with me with like types of interaction that I know from experience don't result in moving towards a collaborative goal, which is probably what the like democracy, like what percentage of the time do we want to have a 49-50 split vote determining right. something that strongly affects people's lives. Like I think a more coordinated democracy would probably get us a lot closer to 100 before the pull cords ripped and the decisions made. Things that are, yeah, broadly tolerable or exciting to a large group of the participants in it.
Yeah, we've talked before about even like what a utopian debate system might look like, some type of guardrails or ways to ensure that you can have more fruitful outcomes from it. The process of resolving disagreements. Because yeah, I agree with you that turning everything into a sort of two camps, A versus B, everybody gets polarized on one side and who's going to feel like they got fucked over and who's going to feel smug that they won this week is like a shitty political world to live in. I think we all know that. We all live in that world.
Yeah. And if you think of it just like pure, like human hours being spent on projects, the amount of human hours being spent on the project of like snide remarks about each other when you guys mostly agree is like mind-boggling. Not as a just from a project manager perspective for the human population's transition to a society that won't obliterate us and our children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, too. Like a lot of the time, like snide remarks comes from not having an actual answer to what, as someone who's consumed a lot of debates, people start getting snide and shitty when they don't know how to counter what the other person has said. Right. Or their other person got snide first and they're like, all right, I'm done with this. Let's just start insulting each other.
So on the subject of hope being a commitment, and you mentioned Mamdani and other, and Trump and stuff like that in the kind of like electoral space, which is, I think that's like the most obvious example. It's because it's the most potent political communications in the world. There's the most media to consume about the electoral circuit. Electoral circuit produces the most materials about their position, platform, and activities. It's like...
And they have power over all the levels of government. And like,
But there's other types of power that don't broadcast themselves as well that I think if we all started cheering for, it could, I don't know. I don't have any proposals
like
there.
Like Eleanor talking about schools being a real decentralized network of very powerful type of community institution that we could align with in certain ways. Yeah, that rings true too. There's a lot of power in some of these other institutions.
And turning those into like electoral type spectacles would be an awful nightmare. And like, it's good that we keep that type of evil coordinated in one place. But I feel like when I think of hope being commitment, and what resonated to me listening to Eleanor there was, I feel so part of the like left-wing social democratic project of the post-Bernie era that's happening in various like Western countries right now. Like within the political communications of these campaigns, they're talking on one level about policies that make people's lives affordable and stuff. And I wouldn't have affordable, like the concept is good, but the word is floppy. And then having that be central to Zohran's success and stuff was interesting to me because it's a little bit, I don't know, it's a very broad message. Like it's more broad, like I'm going to make New York affordable. Is like something that Eric Adams could say, or like Donald Trump could say. And it's just so to the point of just like base voters, broad message. And what was carrying him in harping on that, there's all these great supporting messages that show us he's oriented and his history and so on.
When I think of like his messaging, I don't even think, I've seen it obviously, but I don't think make New York affordable would have even come to mind at all. I would have been like, oh, rent freeze, free buses, transit, the free childcare. I've always loved a free lunch. So the freezing and the freeing, those are the things that all stuck out to me. But they all, their theme, is affordable New York.
Yeah. So it's kind of like that is the theme of his campaign by necessity, even though affordable does not make a great slogan in itself. But so my point in bringing that up, that was kind of a side point, but the point I was building to in bringing up Zohran's campaign messaging is that he's not saying, really, that we can transform society fundamentally. There's maybe a glimmer of that in some of his older shit when he's younger and stuff, but it's like he's not running for mayor on we can transform the world to be ecological, to respect workers, like whatever sort of grand vision that I think a large portion of the population believes is not just a opinion, but like something inside of us that we've got enough information to be like something like that needs to happen in some way. And if it doesn't, it's going to be really bad. And I may be a simple country boy who watches different edgy comedians, but I know this much. If we don't fundamentally transform the direction of our society, we may all be obliterated by these rich capitalist fucks at the top. That's a pretty common sentiment, 20%, maybe 40% of the population or somewhere on there.
Yeah.
And that's part of what the engine of Zoran's victory is, I think. Like, mm-hmm. the hard activists, the people who are showing up all the time and stuff, is that they're not just like, oh, I want free buses next year. They're like, I want the conversation we have in society to be influenced by this campaign. It occurred to me just that, like, kind of those, like, electoral examples, and Bernie as well, he was speaking in, like, the post-Occupy hope and hopeless pendulum swing to ideas that had really been popularized to a wider population over the last 6 years at that time, and, like, the Facebook era is popping off. What makes this stuff work is a level of hope that extends far beyond a specific election or a specific platform point or anything like that, but, like, a larger project that I think I've been thinking about recently, how to articulate it to the broadest audience possible, because I think it's kind of happening, which is, yeah, like, there's a big group of people who believe that the future is possible, or they need the future to be possible. They think we have no option but to find some way to make the future possible. Mm-hmm. And that is, like, a growing and powerful constituency in society that doesn't have the language to coordinate.
One thing that stood out to me about what you said at the beginning was that Zoran's message isn't that we can fundamentally change society. And, like, yeah, when you're thinking about, you know, like, a library socialist utopia where you can get everything you need and have all the political will of anybody else in society. Yeah, obviously he's not talking about that. But in terms of that sphere of politics, that electoral sphere of politics that consumes so much of the thoughts of everyone who cares about the future of society, I just reacted to what you said because I was like, oh, yeah, that's true. But also, it feels untrue because, in some, like, it felt to me watching his campaign like the people who were in on that were talking about a transition to a very different kind of society. And it's almost like a band of possibility thing, in that if you're stuck in this, like, following through the doom spiral scrolling and, like, okay, the inequality is going to keep getting worse, the environment's going to keep getting worse, that we're all going to burn alive in our homes and be tortured by scarcity, and the last ones to burn will be the billionaires in their hideouts, bunkers under the ground, and you can follow that doom spiral all the way down to there. But seeing something like Zoran's campaign, seeing the things Zoran is talking about, even having those introduced to the conversation and having some of them accomplished, feels like a radically better world than the doom spiral world that you were in before. Because, like, actually moving in the other direction gives you even just a glimmer of what the hope spiral can be. And, like, okay, what if that happened? And then it happened a bunch more times in different places around the country. And then that movement and that expansion of what's possible, you build off of that into the direction of, in my opinion, a library socialist utopia. They're embedded in one another. Even when you're taking the first steps towards something, you're moving in a direction. And even if you're not thinking about it in those terms, you can feel that, and it can shift your ability to hope for things or what you might think is possible, or give you a little bit of ability to match your, if possibilities are real in the future, you're seeing this negative possibility as really real and the positive possibility as almost unreal. That can, like, yeah, shift the weights you give those, seeing something happen like that.
Yeah, well, I was writing down, I wrote, hope is a commitment, future is possible, convivial glue of neighborly love is just things that were interesting that we were talking about before. And I hadn't really thought of that as, like, a totalizing system, but this is almost like a framework for, this triangle is almost like a framework for political hope, as just I was thinking through it. And hope is a commitment is, like, there's commitment and integrity are, like, related to each other. Like, the commitment is the personal component of it, which is, like, your disposition of being in action, being committed to the values, not wanting to sell out the values or, like, self-serve instead of serving the values in inappropriate ways and so on. Like, that commitment piece is part of that full political hope that helps orient the world. And, like, knowledge and confidence is, like, the equivalent to the future is possible. Like, the future is possible, we know, based on Phronesis' study. And from that, we have a real sense of confidence about what is possible. A confidence that allows us to take action according to our integrity and our commitments. And then the convivial glue of neighborly love, I think it's also part of why and how we make those commitments. It's part of how we get the knowledge and confidence about transformation. And also just in itself, it's about not being alone, not physically alone, or not around people, but still alone. Like, the neighborly love means that when you're with people, you're not alone, instead of alone, even though you're with people, which is what some of these like really tedious political processes can feel like, is being alone in this hostile, weird space of, yeah, weird political games, rather than that the vibe of being at like a party or barbecue where everyone's hyping each other up and like, nice to meet you is all around. But those three things together, I feel like they're all, I don't want to say this is exhaustive or this is the structure of political hope, but they feel like they all intertwine in interesting ways around that full spectrum, high quality, top shelf, utopian political hope that is required in order to deliver the future that we know is possible and to have a good excuse to have some good parties along the way, which makes it all worthwhile, even if it is true that at the end of material reality, no matter how hard we fight, we're going to find out that the universe itself was fundamentally incompatible with our vision of truth, justice, freedom, distribution of goods and services, neighborly love, and so on.
Yeah.
I don't think that's likely, but I'm saying even if it would be good that we had all the great parties and friendships and relationships and built knowledge and had drive in our lives and had things to do other than...
Yeah, those things are good in themselves, not just because they might be useful towards the end of building a better society. That's just a side bonus. Or, yeah, they're both bonuses. You don't have to make one the side bonus. Yeah, the parties thing is interesting, too, because it can sound almost like goofy or apolitical to say something like that. But if we're talking about neighborly love seriously as a political concept and a political necessity to building a better society, then you need to have parties or get-togethers or cookouts or community spaces. More so than community spaces, like parties, like events where there's a heightened energy above the normal, where like people are feeling good and there's dancing or there's music, or that's why we have festivals and street festivals and carnivals, and the energy from that is like pleasant to be around. But when you put it in the space of neighbors existing in community with one another, it helps you build those social bonds, that neighborly love between you, when you're all out at the same fun event and like you see each other dancing or like playing games of ping pong, hanging out by the pool. Enjoyable group experiences are crucial, not just to like having a good individual life, but to building those bonds that are the glue that will make a democracy more than just like a set of rules or whatever, like the thing that makes it an actual community.
Yeah, and that's like, what's a good place to end up here?
Yeah, I agree. I don't know how to exactly frame it, but I feel like what we're talking about here is like the seriously wrong shit in a way, like the hopeful, evidence-based, phronesis-based idea that like we need each other and we can with each other build something much better is embodied in those principles.
Yeah, and I feel like it's not just materially possible, like it's a fairly large section of the materially possible spectrum.
Yeah.
Those doors, I think, always stay somewhat open and they can be expanded further. I mean, I don't know what visual metaphor you'd have for all the branching many billions of possibilities in every moment of every option. But if you believe me that I've wrapped my head around that enough to make some sort of claim about it, I just, maybe this is on the happy little guest side of the spectrum, but it's the load bearing happy little guest of my utopian political confidence, is I feel like a lot of the half and half roughly is utopia.
Yeah.
Or utopian. Utopian direction.
And it's utopian of center, at least, by exactly, definition.
Exactly. Yeah. Half of all possible universes are utopian of center. So we can.
Yeah, that's pretty good odds, if you ask me, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, would I prefer better odds? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, we've been living in dystopian of center for a while, so you're like, it's not always that bad. Oh, yeah, I guess. I'm just assuming where the center is.
But... No, that's a good happy little guess. Let's stay with that. It turns out we're like extremely utopian of center. That'd be a bummer. It's all right. You can reflect on the good aspects of life while still trying to achieve full utopia. Yeah, half of all universes are utopian of center, you know? Take that home with you, put that in your back pocket, feed that to your dog, put that in your pipe and smoke it. This is the Seriously Wrong podcast. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, have a wonderful life and week.
And I hope like the moment after this episode is over, something fantastic happens. Like a cherry on top.
That was a nice way to say goodbye.